Hi, Xian Qi here, Executive Director of Byron Writers Festival. You're listening to the Ideas Salon podcast series, recorded live at Byron Writers Festival in 2023. The following recording of our 2023 Mungo panel, The Future of Journalism, is a heated conversation featuring Monica Attard, Osman Faruqi, Paddy Manning and Amy Romikas.
Hi, I'm Jenny Caffin, and I've been invited by the festival to intrude on this session in order to pay tribute to a significant Northern Rivers writerly resident, Dr. Mary Gardner. Now, Mary and Mungo were great friends, and in fact, Mungo's partner Jenny and Mary's partner Jim are both in the tent today, so I think Mungo would be delighted to see us all here. For over a decade, the Byron Shire Echo published Tangles of Life, Mary's weekly column. In it, she passionately chronicled her observational walking and snorkeling adventures around Byron Shire. With her marine biologist's perspective, she plunged into local knowledge and the water cycles. She was able to bring us all into a deep sense of place and wonder. It was a wonderful experience that led her to pursue and attain a Doctor of Philosophy in Environmental Science. Now, when Mary was diagnosed with a terminal illness, she was determined to collate her columns into a book. And so she marshalled her friends. Eventually, Rosie Whelan, Joe Immig and I took on the role of editors. We had no idea what a long and winding road that was going to be. And sadly, Mary didn't complete the journey with us. However, plant a tree, grow a fish, nature essays from Byron Bay did make the journey. Now, this is a unique style of nature writing which marries poetry, science, history, whimsy, and wild imagination into a shimmering mosaic. It's both a love story and an action plan for everyone whose curiosity is piqued by the fragile riches of our coast and hinterland. I'm going to read you a quick quote from E.J. Banfield, author of Confessions of a Beachcomber, which is a book that Mary loved. On rare occasions, there comes along a profound original, an odd little book that appears out of nowhere, from the pen of some obscure storyteller. And once you've read it, you'll never go back completely to where you were before. The kind of book you might hesitate to lend for fear you might miss its company. Plant a Tree, Grow a Fish, Nature Essays from Byron Bay is such a book. It's available in this limited edition in the bookshop here. I would urge you all to go and buy a copy to discover why Mary was famous for encouraging us to think like a fish. This is Mary's legacy. This is her gift of love to the community in which she was so passionately involved. I'd like to welcome proud Bundjalung woman Delta Kay to say a few words about her beloved friend.
I'm very proud to be here, and I want to pay my love and respects to Jenny and Jim, both incredible partners to these community people. I miss Mary. We all miss Mary. I miss this woman that has this incredible joy in her whole way of being. Whether she's at my house and we're both poking the frog poo, or as we walk down the Tallow Creek in the footsteps of my elders, and she'd be asking all these incredible questions. And I can just watch the way her mind just clicks over. And Mary got it. She got the way that Bundjalung people be and do on country. She spoke so eloquently about my elders. She quietly and humbly in the background would advocate and continue to advocate when our elders passed away to care for country. Myself and many, many Byron locals paid tribute to this woman, not just me, but all of us. She's cheeky, absolutely honest, and terribly missed. So this book will sit in the pride place in my lounge room, and I recommend everyone buy this book and have Mary in your lounge room too. Boogle Bear, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for that. And I would wish to pay tribute to Delta and her people and the country in which we are meeting on. And I've said this before, but again, we're entering a very traumatic and tumultuous time for our Indigenous people in a referendum that was not necessarily all of their choice and a debate that is not particularly safe. So for all of the Indigenous people around you, just watch out for them. Don't make them do any extra labour, and do what you can to create as many safe places as possible as we work our way to probably October 14 and, of course, beyond. Also, I apologise for the little interloper. He's being a little bit clingy this afternoon. Little Canberra baby's not particularly dealing with the Byron heat particularly well. I'm ashamed as a Queenslander, but we'll have a talk about that later. My name is Amy Romakis. I'm a journalist with Guardian Australia, and I am so honoured to be moderating this panel, the Mungo panel, where we look at the future of journalism. And to do that, you have three of the best people you could possibly hope to hear from. So we have Monica Attard, Osman Faruqi, and Paddy Manning. And we're going to be doing this. Thank you. We're going to be having this chat in the spirit of Mungo, who one of my favourite quotes from Gough Whitlam, describing him as tall, bearded descendant of lunatic aristocrats, which, you know, sounds like my kind of people. So we're going to have an honest discussion about the media. Yes, we all work for the media, and I'm not going to, not all journalists, we're not here to do that. We're going to be as honest and open as possible. What you hear, you may not necessarily agree with, but I'd like you just to sit and think with it, because it is coming from a place of truth and experience. So I'm going to open up to anyone who wants to take this in the panel, but how do you each see the state of media now and where we're going?
Wowee. You're the expert on it, Mike.
No, I'm not. How did that come about? Look, it's fractured. I mean, at the moment, it's really fractured, and it has been for probably the last 10 years, and it's kind of become a little worse with every year. That has, when I say worse, I mean, there's a positive side as well, because with the fracturing comes a greater diversity of information sources and clearly views, and that's not a bad thing in a country where media concentration is so profound and obvious. We all know the statistics, you know, the Murdoch Corporation, Paddy will correct me if I'm wrong here, own some 70% of the print media output across metro and regional locations. Their footprint in regional location is quite significant and growing. It's an interesting development because it's growing but on the cheap. So, you know, it's only very, very cursory coverage of regional affairs rather than investigative work. But, you know, the issue of pluralism in the media is a big one for Australia because the population is relatively small and unable to sustain much more than we have. There have been some interesting new entrants like yours, Amy, with Guardian Australia entering the field. I think, though, one of the other things that I'd like to comment about is that over the last 10 years, what we've seen is a more kind of bifurcated media. So you've got, you know, a lot on the far, on the extreme right-wing end of the spectrum, and then you know, organisations such as your own and others on the extreme left. And then you've got some paddling down the middle, producing, you know, trying to be, you know, non-partisan and non-advocate, but they, as a result, turn out to be quite beige in some parts, you know. And I say that as well of the organisation that I spent my life devoted to, which is the ABC. So, you know, so it's a really kind of complex environment. I think one of the other things, though, that we see happening right now, which I'm taking a little bit of hope in, actually, we all might have loved Twitter for the last 10 years. It's been a great nurturing space for us to live in, to get new ideas in, to be exposed to things that we wouldn't otherwise have been exposed to. Elon has put paid to that, and he's ruining that space for us. And I think as we see Twitter or X, I've got to be careful because I've called it Z in the past, which is not what I want to call it. But as we see X kind of, you know, diluting and fracturing a little bit, we might actually begin to see that people are getting their news directly from websites, which would be great. So rather than kind of using social media as a platform of curation, that they go directly to websites. That's what I'm hoping we will see more and more of in the next year or two.
Unless that website is the Daily Mail. So, Osman, what do you think?
I agree with a lot of what Monica... Actually, very quickly, sorry for wearing sunglasses. I left my actual glasses in my jacket pocket. It's such a nice day. I didn't
bring them. You were being really cool there, Oz.
No. I just can't see you beautiful people without them, so I'm keeping them on. The only thing I kind of was thinking while Monica was talking that I think is slightly different or what makes me feel a little bit optimistic about the current situation is that with the fracturing of the kind of legacy media we had for so long, where if you wanted to know what was going on in the world, you had to turn to one of the five free-to-air networks or one of the two papers in whichever capital city you lived in, there's been a rise in smaller independent media outlets. There's the Saturday paper that Paddy writes for a lot, the 7 a.m. podcast that he's on a lot, even blogs like Pearls and Irritation, The New Daily, those sorts of outlets didn't used to exist and can only exist in this fractured landscape. And I think that is exciting. I don't think it's all doom and gloom. There are more places to get your news from than ever, though, as Monica points out, they all tend to have a bit more of a political perspective. But I think the challenge that remains is that to do some of the biggest, heaviest investigative work in this country to hold the most powerful people to account takes a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of resources. And you do need, and it's not me defending any individual company, but there is a place and there's a necessity to have bigger media companies that can do things like the Ben Robert Smith investigation, for example. That takes years to do. It takes years to be in court. It's costing tens of millions of dollars. So as exciting as it is to see newer and smaller players emerge, I do think we need to still find a way to have bigger media companies, hopefully more of them across different kinds of perspectives. I don't think it's going to be a great outcome if we end up with one or two large companies and then 100 smaller ones. Mm-hmm. We need to find a way to have a much healthier, competitive, robust media landscape with a lot of players that can do a lot of big investigative stuff as well.
When we're talking about bigger media organisations, as Monica has touched on, the biggest is News Corp. Paddy, you're our resident expert on that. News Corp, what do we think about it? Do we still think it's a media organisation, or is it time to classify it as a political one?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I do think it is a media organisation, and I think it gets a bit kind of glib sometimes, the discussion about the Murdoch media. I was thinking overnight that really the journalist, if you think about it, that did the most damage to the Morrison government was Sam Maiden from news.com.au, who, you know, revealed, because she wouldn't be fobbed off, that, you know, in the middle of the black summer, Scott Morrison had gone off on a holiday in Hawaii. And we wouldn't know that if she hadn't persisted. And then her work as well on, you know, the Brittany Higgins story. And I think that, yeah, so when Malcolm Turnbull says, you know, that the Murdoch media now operates as an extension of the LNP, I think that's a great line, and Turnbull has a lot of great lines, but it's not actually true. So I do think, for example, in the coup against Malcolm Turnbull, there were people like Peter Credlin at Sky News who were overstepping the boundary between, you know, commentator or journalist in a way, and she has had a Walkley Award, let's not forget, between journalist and political operator. But then so was Ray Hadley at 2GB. And so I don't think it's a blind News Corp conspiracy. It's the blind News Corp conspiracy that Malcolm Turnbull alleges. I think he wasn't knocked off by a media organisation. He was knocked off by his colleagues. And, yeah, I just to add to some of what Oz and Monica have said, one note of, you know, optimism for me is that concentrating on sort of Fox News and the Murdoch media as I have been in the last few years, and I'm on this train now for another few years. Yeah, we at least, I think, compared to America, do still have a media that has a something like a shared set of facts and a shared reality, which they don't. It's kind of scary, but they don't have that there. So the right watch right-wing media in America, and the left watch, read and consume the rest. And they don't meet very much in the middle at all. So a big story in my world was earlier this year the settlement for $787 million of a defamation case by Dominion against Fox. On the right, they didn't read about that story. They didn't know, watching Fox News. They weren't even allowed to mention it until very late, and it was only too little too late. So they didn't even know that the network they were watching, and it's so siloed, they didn't even really know about the court case, and it didn't affect their ratings at all. So we, at least in Australia, I think, between big and large media organisations, still have enough of a sensible centre and enough of a shared reality that we haven't completely... We're fractured, sure, but we haven't completely fractured. We're not as polarised as America, and I think that's a great thing.
Monica, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Patty, and I would also add, I mean, it is a very popular thing to say, you know, News Corp has become a political organisation, and it comes from the same kind of quarters and the same people all the time. That ignores the fact that, in fact, there are some very, very good journalists at News Corp who do report in the public interest and who do report objectively, and they have broken a lot of fantastic stories, and they've done great investigative work. I think that's one point I wanted to make. But the second is that, you know, since time immemorial, it's been the right of newspaper proprietors to hold, to have their newspapers occupy particular political ground. I mean, Fairfax did it for, you know, hundreds of years, and Murdoch has done the same thing. I mean, it's what commercial newspapers, they're the only ones, but it's what commercial media does. It occupies a political space. And you know, because some people, Turnbull, Rudd, many, many others, might not like that, you know, that particular space, doesn't invalidate, and certainly doesn't mean that they don't produce good journalism. Although at the same time, obviously, it's important to recognise that they can sometimes imbue their straight news with a political perspective that's not always, you know, reality.
I have a slightly different perspective
yeah.
on this. And I, it doesn't necessarily... The contention that you raise, Monica, that they sometimes do good journalism, I think that's true and fair enough. But I think the question of what News Corp is as an entity across its suite of publications, TV networks, online sites, what its primary purpose in Australian society seems to be, to me at this stage, is not primarily about doing good journalism, but it is primarily about, and has been for a while, waging ideological conflicts on a whole raft of issues. And I think not...
I live in Queensland. Don't tell me that there's good journalism coming out of Queensland.
Sure.
Because I don't have any option but to read
the Courier Mail.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Adelaide, ditto South.
Yeah, no, we're on board. That's what we're talking about. On board. But I think, and I think the question of whether it's a political institution doesn't just have to be focused on is it supportive of the LNP versus Labor. I think largely it would like Conservative governments more than Labor governments, but when I think about its political battles that it wages, they go beyond just like who you should vote for in an election on the fundamental issues of this country around, you know, corporate power versus the power of regular people, on significant issues to do with Indigenous sovereignty, on migration and multiculturalism, even on gender and the rights of women to not be sexually assaulted. News Corp picks very specific ideological lines on that and wages them pretty ruthlessly. And I think that makes it quite distinct, even if the Fairfax Papers or the ABC or the Guardian sometimes skew one way or another. I don't think they see themselves, and I don't think regular people see them, as institutions that primarily exist to push the country in one direction.
Mm. I wouldn't disagree with that, any of that, Osman, but I think what you're talking about there is their methodology. I mean, you know, those of us who've been reading, you know, who've been journalists for a long time have sat back and looked at the way the Murdoch press have, Murdoch media generally have kind of picked on people, you know, taken a cause, attached a human being, a human face to it, and prosecuted their case mercilessly. And it's really, really rough. And, I've been at the butt end of that as well. Yeah. And it's really nasty and it's threatening and all the rest of it. So I wouldn't disagree with that proposition. But I think that's a question of methodology rather than, you know, their overall... Their reason to be is... as a journalism organisation. It's not as an organisation to prosecute any particular issue. They just pick issues that happen to suit their political bent, and then they pick a person to pick on in order to drive their point home. I mean, that's their problem, and that's what they get criticised for.
But is that necessarily true anymore, Patty? Because particularly with what we've seen in America, there has been a shift where griftertainment does get attention and it does get dollars. And so it might not even be their politics anymore. It's what they think are going to get eyeballs on Fox News. It's what's going to get eyeballs on the tabloids. It's the attempt to try and get the Oz to dictate what they see should be the national narrative, even if, like, you know, most reasonable thinking people would never even have considered taking that line.
Yeah.
So is it even their politics anymore, or is it just wreck things as much as possible because that's going to bring the dollar?
I don't think I can answer that really. I think, you know, Elizabeth Warren in the States called Fox News a hate-for-profit racket. If you're a Democrat voter, you might be inclined to agree. And there is no question, you know, the more I look at it, the more I understand, I suppose, the very obvious thing that it makes a ton of money. So for them, $787 million payout is like, whoosh, it's in the rearview mirror, because they just reported their profits this week, and yeah, they've got net cash of $1.8 billion a year that they make. They've got $4 billion on their balance sheet ready to deploy at any time. News Corporation, despite the headlines you saw on Friday, is actually not doing too badly either. So they do make a hell of a lot of money. That's true. you know, on the in the conversation, I don't want to repeat what was said yesterday, but, you know, on a panel that Monica and Andy Lowenstein were on yesterday, they were talking about, you know, let's all sometimes read media that we don't agree with. Like, you know, that there is that we don't want to end up in echo chambers, and you might not agree, Oz, with, you know, half or even 99.9% of what you read in the Oz. But, you know, I read it. I suppose I have to. I'm guessing you read it as well.
Sadly.
So,
I don't need to. My dad just gives me a running commentary. It's fine.
Well, what would your dad say if he was sitting here? You know, I don't want to end up being the Murdoch defender, although...
My dad would say, bloody academics, off with the fairies, don't understand how the real world works.
Now, I reckon I know at least 100 people that I would agree with him. You know what I mean? And so, like it or lump it, there is a market. That market does, you know, and I agree it is an ideological position. In fact, it's an ideal. If you say profit is the most important thing, that's an ideological position in itself. And they have made a whole bunch of choices over a very long period of time. You know, the monopoly that you're complaining about, sir, in South Australia, Queensland, Tasmania, that dates to 1987. Mm. There's nothing new about that. Paul Keating did that, you know. So
WA is in a similar position but with a different organisation.
Yeah, yeah. When they bought the Herald and Weekly Times, they got a monopoly. We've got the most concentrated media market in the world, and we're still squirming and trying to work out what to do with it. I was reading, this is a diversion, but I was in the archives at the ANU 2 weeks ago reading the Australian Journalists Association warning in 1979 that if Rupert Murdoch bought the Herald and Weekly Times, we would be, you know, the media concentration would be unacceptable for our democracy. And they called for a royal commission into media ownership. Here we are in 2023, still going, we need a royal commission into media ownership. It's like... what has happened is social media. What has happened when you talk about doing regional journalism on the cheap? What we've just learned in the last 2 weeks, courtesy of a story in The Guardian, is that they've actually, it's robo coverage. They've actually got ChatGPT, they've got automated stories getting written in regional locations.
Limited.
3,000 a week.
Yeah, limited though, to weather traffic reports and weather traffic
for
reports
now.
And. For now, yeah.
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 So a lot of, like, there's one guy who's getting like 3,000 bylines a week or something. There's one guy. So I think that's a worry. Yeah, I think the union at the Oz is just because they didn't even know it was going on. The union at News Limited is kind of going, please explain letter to management.
Yeah, and it's been a while since the union at the Oz is really like
they've woken up.
So, but. Oz, I want to talk to you about this idea of influence and whether the media actually has it. Because there, for a long time, there seemed to be this idea that, you know, not to keep harping on about News Corp, but if Murdoch Press backed in somebody that they would be a winner, when in reality it was probably more that they were good at reading the changing winds and then backing who was going to win anyway and then saying, well, we backed you in, you won because of us and therefore you owe us. But in recent years, we've seen a change where, like, whatever you want to call it, they're just going to continue backing in a losing horse and then just continue to wage war. And we're seeing some of that influence, some of people questioning, you know, oh, does the media not have influence anymore? And we're seeing some other organisations kind of get a bit scared in the direction that maybe the biggest news corporation is going in the country and going, well, maybe we should follow what they're doing because that's what they're saying. I mean, how do you see the influence?
So it's a really good question that has an annoyingly complicated answer. So I think I think it is true, definitely, that the mainstream kind of larger media organizations in this country have less influence in one way than they used to 10 or 20 years ago. And I think that's not really a radical proposition. If you just look at circulation figures and TV viewership figures, that is just a fact. Four Corners used to attract 1 to 1.5 million people on Monday nights. Now it attracts less than 500,000 people on Monday nights. Now that is still 500,000 people. Like, that's still a lot of people that watch that television show. And more importantly, perhaps, the kinds of people that watch that show are the elites in our society who make decisions over, you know, whether they're on the boards of companies or whether they're ministers sitting around a cabinet table. So on one hand, yeah, numbers are lower. And there's more competition, so you can't dictate the political debate in this country just by having a front page the way that you used to be able to. But lots of Australians still consume one or two or three key bits of information. But I think the thing that hasn't really been broken yet is that our politicians and our business leaders and our union leaders, basically that kind of top tier that decide how everything's run, they still are very wedded to traditional news outlets. The Australian newspaper is not read by very many people at all in this country, but it is read by every single politician and every single business CEO and every single union leader. And that gives those kinds of newspapers, I think, an outsized influence. Even Radio National on the ABC, Aaron's breakfast program, its listenership is sometimes less than the 7 a.m. podcast that Paddy appears on. But very few politicians listen to it and very few politicians go on it. And I think that is leading to a growing divergence, I think, between what regular people think is important and what they want talked about and the issues they want discussed versus what the kind of like the powerful people in this country think. And I think that's probably a generational thing that needs to change.
Because, I mean, Monica, I've spoken to former ministers who have said that, you know, and from a conservative side of politics, who have said that they would go back to their branches wanting to talk about policy, and all their branches would want to talk about is what Peter Credlin or Andrew Bolt had said on Sky, because that's what they were focused on. Mm-hmm. And so that just kind of led to a chicken and egg thing. I mean, I think Sky's highest viewership is on Capitol Hill, which my father also likes to call Bullshit Castle. But that would be like it's high, like it's on every single office in Parliament, and that is, as Osman is talking about, is that that influence. But Monica, what do you think, as someone who's been in media for longer than us?
Well, do I think that they have, that Sky has influence?
Well, the media still has influence, and whether influencing that top echelon of society is what's trickling down.
Well, yeah. I mean, if it's trickling down, in fact, you would have more of an idea being in Parliament House on how significantly it's trickling down. I think the move by Sky into regional Australia is a bit of a worrying thing. In fact, I think it's deeply worrying.
Do you guys get it here?
Yeah. And, you know, which is, and I'm only referring to Sky After Dark there, not Sky Before Dark, but After Dark, it's pretty toxic, and I think the fact that they've made that move is pretty significant, and it may well end up having some electoral impact. I really have no idea, but we'll wait and see. I don't think we've actually had an election where they've been in the regions, have we, Paddy? No, because the last election, I think it only started up after the last election, that deal.
What, the Southern Cross deal?
Yeah.
I think it was in place 21. Before.
Was it before?
Yeah. No, okay. It was in place before, yeah.
But we may well see, you know, some impact from that in future elections. You know, I think as a metro-based person, I mean, I find it extraordinary because really, who watches Sky? I mean, nobody watches Sky. You've got to pay for it in the first place, but in the city. But it's their use of social media. It's their amplification of their messaging on social media, which is I think particularly worrying. And you know, that can get picked up and put into those little vortexes, and then it filters out and it amplifies even further. So that, I think, is particularly worrying. In relation to the overall question, though, whether media still has as much influence, I think social media has really put a big dent in that. I mean, we're no longer the gatekeepers of information. You know, the gatekeepers are all you. If you tell us what you want to talk about, that's what we end up talking about. And it's churlish to think that editors don't take notice of that, because they do. You would know that, Oz, from, you know, from your various positions in the area of journalism in which you operate. So I think that it's a combination of, I think social media has had a very positive kind of democratizing impact, and I think it's had a really toxic impact on the way media operates at the same time. And I'm a bit worried that unless the government does something to flex its muscles with the platforms, that toxicity might actually worsen in the next little while.
Can I get a show of hands of people who watch the 6 o'clock news?
ABC's on 7
p.m. That, any 6 or
that's ABC 7 o'clock but
yeah,
commercial
that was
6
p.m. 6 p.m. any channel ABC on 7 p.m.
wow.
Anyone who watches breakfast television that is not the ABC, so 7 or 9 or 10. Who watches yeah.
Not even when I'm on the Today Show, come on.
It's when you're waiting to see a doctor.
When you're waiting to see a... Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about SBS?
Oh, and SBS, of course. Who watches SBS?
Yeah.
Who would say, though, that they get most of their media consumption from social media? That would probably be against... Like, it would be generational, and it would probably be against where most of the rest of the nation does. And I don't mean any shade from that. We get into habits, right? But what we're seeing in Australia at the moment is the biggest demographic shift we have seen since the baby boomers were born. And that is, as of the last census, there are the same number of millennials, my generation, as there are baby boomers. And that was a couple of years ago. And the linear nature of time means that there are now more millennials than baby boomers.
Tragic,
which
really.
Means that we are slowly, for the first time,
yeah.
seeing a shift, a political shift of who holds the power. And I can tell you, like, millennials and younger, we're pretty fucking angry. Pretty angry. We have not seen wage growth in more than a decade. We cannot afford houses. We cannot afford to rent. And we are bucking trends politically and not growing more conservative as we grow older because we've got no wealth to protect. We've got nothing to conserve. So we're not going more conservative. So I want to ask the panel... Is that demographic shift what sees the Australian media shift? Because as we've sort of looked at, we go where the dollar is if you're in commercial media, and the dollar may not necessarily be with who has traditionally held power in this country.
Such a good point to make. I think when we're talking about like bubbles of media consumption, the generational one is massive. There is a group of people over a certain age, you know, 45, 50, who still get most of their news from newspapers and television, and the cohort under who don't really know what they are. Like when I hang out with people younger than me and I say I work at the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, they say, oh, that's the paper with the old-timey logo on it. And that's kind of our fault in a way. We haven't done a good enough job to tell younger people why they should buy our paper and engage with it, but that gap is real. The really funny thing about your question is that that is where the dollars are. That is where if media businesses were smart, they would invest time and money. But every single organization I've worked in, I've worked in many big and small news organizations in this country, they are really slow to do that. They're really slow to adapt. A lot of the... There's this term that's become quite popular in US politics in the last few months, gentocracy, which refers to like Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden, Donald Trump, the kind of people who run the show politically being over the age of 80, which is extraordinary. Our media companies might not be that extreme, but very few young people are getting the opportunity to rise to be...
92 is pretty extreme.
92 is very extreme. Very few young people are getting the chance in media to either be senior journalists, senior editors, the decision makers in media companies that decide where to allocate resources. And so I think what's happening is young people aren't getting their news on social media from the ABC or from the Herald or from the Guardian. They're getting it from YouTubers and TikTokers that I don't even know the names of, but they have millions of followers. And that's really fascinating. I'm not saying whether it's good or bad, but I think many organisations have been very late to the party.
The ABC's going there, though, now. I mean,
it's trying to look like it's doing it, but having been there at a time when, like, the amount of money that still goes to, like, TV broadcast versus trying to get people under 30, it's an orders of magnitude.
Yeah, no, I agree. But at least they've now come up with a policy which says, you know, resources are going to be shifted towards where young audiences are, and that thing about young. I mean, I work in a university with lots and lots of journalism students, and some of the things that you hear them say, oh my God, I just want to shoot myself. But I mean, you know, I remember once sitting with a group of undergraduates and asking them, okay, let's just figure out what you know about the Australian media. Who owns the ABC? And somebody said Fairfax.
Yeah.
Other kids who say, when you say, why do you want to become a journalist, will say, because I have views and I want to share them. And you just think, like, just shoot me now. I just want to die.
Well, I mean, on that, though, is it time to stop pretending that journalists don't have biases?
No, it's not. It's not time to start thinking that at all. I mean, it's time for journalists to say, we're human, we have biases, but we have a particular way, we have been schooled to use a particular methodology to produce our journalism, and that should guide what comes out at the other end, and that we are trained to leave our biases at the door when we go in to do a story, and that we can come out with something that is remotely resembling public interest journalism, not advocacy journalism. Because I think, I'm sorry, but I just think advocacy journalism is incredibly polarizing, and it has created a level of mistrust across the audience base that is going to be very, very difficult to come out to escape from. You know, we need people to trust what we do and what we say, because we are an important element of any functioning democratic society. And in order to do that, we need to be objective. We might not like the term, but I've had it schooled into me from people like Patty's dad way back. You know, this is what you're doing, girl. You know, you go down that road and you're going down the wrong way. I mean, it is important that we get back to basics in journalism, and that is objective journalism that is conducted in the public interest for the public, not for any particular interest group. Mm.
Can I just add a little to that, which is that, and thanks for mentioning my dad.
He's awesome,
Peter Manning,
that's why.
Who was a great friend of Mungo McCallum also. So anyway, just to acknowledge. But to say that it was really interesting to me that when they looked at the what can ChatGPT, what can these large language models do, they can't verify facts. They can turn out lots of words, but you can't actually rely on them, and they make mistakes when it comes to actually getting the details right. And I thought, that sounds like a job for a journalist. That sounds like our jobs are not going to be automated out of existence.
Just yet.
Yeah, that might be overly optimistic, but I still agree that you have to try, even if it's something that is you can never achieve perfectly, like a more perfect union. You nevertheless try to be as objective as you can every single time.
The product will never, ever, ever be perfect when a human is doing it. Mm-hmm. That's what you're saying, and that's really important to remember. And journalism will never be the absolute truth. It'll be the closest approximation to the truth when it's done properly.
I think, though, that where objectivity has gotten a bit muddled is not necessarily with, you know, activist journalism, although that can definitely do it. It's when we start doing false equivalence or false balance, because sometimes a fact is a fact and there is no other side. Yeah. There isn't other side of climate science, for example.
Completely.
But yet this country was held hostage for more than a decade by people pretending that there was another side to climate science. And
not just that, we saw our most objective institutions, such as the ABC, give a lot of time to false balance to try and show objectivity on that. So, Oz, how do we deal with that?
Oof, jeez. It's a really, like, yeah, I'm saying it a lot. You're asking great questions. I promise I'm not just saying that for the sake of it. I agree with it, like, basically everything that Monica said. But I think that one of the things that I see play out every day, which it's the exact point. Human beings are not robots. They're not perfect, and they make judgment calls every day, right? So even before you get to reporting a story, or before that story's commissioned or put in the paper on an online website where it goes, editors decide whether it is a story or it isn't a story. You know, I sit around newsroom meetings every single day, and people say, that doesn't really interest me. I don't really think that's a story. Ugh, they say, that does interest me. And often that has to do with what they personally care about, where they live, the issues that impact them, their life experiences, what impacts their neighborhood. They're much more likely to commission and give prominence to stories like that than they will to stories that have to do with, I don't know, offshore detention, for example. And this is an ongoing problem, I think, in our media and in media all around the place. So that not really a direct answer to your question, Amy, but I think what I'm trying to illustrate with that example is that even everyone's best attempts to be objective still mean that you're bringing, like, your own lived experience and internal biases to what you think is newsworthy and not. And I don't think there's a clear fix to that other than, like, having newsrooms that don't just have the same kind of person making those decisions. And I think ultimately I'd rather just see, if you assume you can't make everyone a robot who's perfect and unbiased, which I think we all agree is probably the case, then the next best solution is to have lots of different things going on, right? It means you need lots of different news organizations with lots of different journalists from lots of different class backgrounds, gender backgrounds, race back, all those different things, because you can't force everyone to be a perfect person who could input every fact and come out with an unbiased output. I think that's really the only solution to this perennial question of bias and perspective.
And on top of that diversity, have journalists conform to a tried and true formula of producing journalism? I mean, there's a methodology to producing journalism. You know, it's the collation of facts. It's the analysis or information, and the analysis of that information to determine whether it has any factual basis. And if it doesn't, then discarding that. So that gets rid of the false equivalence that you're talking about, Amy. And then, you know, then subjecting it, when it's put together, to a process of verification. I mean, there are steps that you do in journalism that can produce a good product at the end that has taken as much kind of personal positioning out of it as possible. And if we get back to that rather than, you know, starting our journalism with one proposition and then gathering evidence to support that proposition because it suits, you know, where you want to advocate, which is what we see a lot of, then I think we'll all be better off.
Yes. Patty, why is the media so terrible at critiquing itself? Why are we so bad at calling out shit journalism?
I think it's partly to do with the concentration of the media market that we've got here. And, you know, as someone who's lost a job for criticising my employer, which I did...
Sorry for laughing. It's a good story, though.
It is. Come on, Patty, tell us a story.
Just Google Patty Manning sacked.
And, it's the fourth story about that.
Yeah, that's right. It used to be my top search result. But, I think it's very injurious to your own career to go around criticising other media organisations in this country, because there's only one or two shops that really hire meaningful numbers of journalists. And so that is an issue. And I do think there is a bit of a closed shop because journalists have egos and they are thin-skinned. And they don't like to have their reporting besmirched or have, you know, to admit that they've got something wrong. And we're all guilty of it. And so I think that's probably a cultural thing. you know, there should be more. I agree with you. I mean, social media, unfortunately, feels like it's dying to me, not only because I love Twitter, but Twitter was a great leveller, you know, for a while there. And yes, it was good to see how many followers you had, but it was also... not in my case, because it's a pretty small number, but you know, there were some journalists getting really... really great followings, but there was also a back channel. I mean, I don't like the celebrification of journalism. I don't like journalists turning into stars. I think, you know, I love, in some ways, hanker for the old days where there were no bylines, and it's like, okay, if it's a good enough story to print, it doesn't matter who wrote it, because it shouldn't matter who wrote it, because we're telling the story straight. And I sort of pine for that.
You can read The Economist.
Hey, yes, read I know.
Yeah. It's funny because I think journalists can have a particular kind of they have a particular personality, you know, and they like to they always think they're right.
Frustrated drama students, I've found.
Yeah, they're always right, and everybody else is always wrong. And because they've got they hold the bugle, you know, that kind of gives them even greater confidence that they're always right. And I can tell you, as the former host of Media Watch, I am still paying the price for having criticised some journalists.
Wow.
To this day, they don't talk to me. Or they see me in public and they'll kind of turn around on their heels and walk the other way. And at the time, it was really, you know, it was really intense. I don't know how the guys who, you know, Jonathan Holmes and Paul Barry have done it for multiple years, because it would kill me. I mean, it was just shocking to wake up on a Tuesday morning to phone calls that would not stop with you having to hold your phone out here because you've got journalists screaming at you. They don't like to be criticised. They don't like to be told they're wrong. They don't like to be, they don't like to be critiqued at all.
So everyone really does love it until they're on it.
Absolutely.
I'd like to finish on a note of hope with what's going right with media in Australia. So if each of you could just give us where you think we're going right and how that is actually going to aid our democracy, which is a lot more unstable, I think, than we give it credit for, and it's something we need to look after and nourish. So, Monica, what's going right?
Oh, well, just briefly, I think two things. One is that, and they've already been mentioned, but one, the point that Oz made very eloquently about diversity, I mean, I think it is improving, not only diversity of media outlets, but diversity of journalists working within the media. So we're seeing a lot more, you know, different looking people and people from different socioeconomic backgrounds appearing in the media, and that can only be a good thing. And the other issue, which has also been mentioned, is that, you know, we do have many, 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 many more digital outlets than we had 10, even 5 years ago, frankly, and that can only be a good thing. So two big pluses from me.
Stole my 2 points.
Sorry.
That's it. There's only two good things in the media.
I think a few hundred people coming to listen to us talk about the future of media is pretty exciting. I think there's a lot of interest in what media looks like, even if it doesn't always get reflected in the pages of the news or on the TV news. There is a lot of interest in, from what I see in my line of work, talking to people about how does the news work? Why does it look like the way it does? How do we make it better? I think there is a lot of conversation happening across the West, but in Australia around that fact as well. And I do feel positive about the development of new outlets. Like, there's a new company about to launch in a few weeks. It's got a weird name. It's called
Skyr.
Yeah.
It's started by an ex-Fairfax guy, Chris Jans. They've hired a bunch of pretty good journalists from around the place. And that's exciting to see the rise of, like, you know, like I mentioned, Pearls and Invitation, New Delhi, those sorts of free websites, but also subscription-based premium offerings. I think we are out of the doldrums where everything was shutting down and there were redundancy rounds every few months. I think things are starting to get a little bit better, and that is exciting.
Yeah, that's true. The digital revenue streams are there, although I find it's like whack-a-mole with your subscriptions. And I've only just really, after years of battling them, realised they're probably paying for a hell of a lot of journalists, all those subscriptions you're trying to get rid of and those stupid auto-renews. And so at some point, you know, the humans will win and the auto-renew will lose, and that will be a problem, I think, for a lot of media organisations. But yeah, I think probably one good optimistic note is what you suggested, Amy, that yeah, young people will take over. And I know it was funny. I was at a Centre of for Independent Studies think tank session the other day with Tony Abbott and a bunch of people talking about the future of the Liberal Party, interestingly enough.
Is that where he said that he was sick of Welcome to Countries?
No, I missed that one. He comes up with the best lines, doesn't he? So anyway, but yeah, that they were talking about, they were a bit scared. They'd had Andrew Neil out, the UK Spectator. They'd had Andrew Neil out recently, and they were getting a bit scared about what happens when Rupert dies. Like, what? Who is going to support the right wing, like crazy ideas like Brexit, when Rupert's gone? And I'd never really thought about it. I'd never felt sorry for a Conservative before. But yeah, they're going to lose their best friend and ally at some point. And I think it is a nightmare scenario for all of these legacy media organisations like Fox News. If you, their demographics are terrible, they, and I'm sure Sky would be the same. And yeah, hopefully that, you know, the wheels will keep turning. I mean, the amount of disruption in the media is incredible. So it's very hard to think, for example, of a fourth generation of Murdochs running the world.
Your book very eloquently goes into that. So there you have it. The good news is that people will eventually die. Thank you so much for joining us for this conversation. Thank you to our wonderful panelists, and enjoy the rest of your festival.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can find more of our festival conversations online at byronwritersfestival.com/digital.